Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving, and gear. Oh, and forgot about that. Watches as well. This is episode 379, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you'd like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is Jason Heaton, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host, James Stacey. James, just thought I'd throw a little wrench in things. I don't think we've ever done that with the intro. I hope that's not sacrilege.
No, we'll leave it in, man. In the age of AI, we've got to accept that the mistakes are what make us special.
Right.
I think that's fine. Lord knows I've definitely done ones where we have to do this three or four times, and I just keep the good one. That's good. And I promise there will be plenty of watches in this episode, so I'm glad that we added that in.
Yes, indeed.
Well, great. So how have you been?
I've been doing pretty well. Not much exciting stuff to report here, other than we had a great meetup in St. Paul just on Saturday.
Nice.
Steve T from the Slack group, he's been in town or actually in Minnesota for several weeks now, visiting family and staying in an Airbnb with his own family. And they've had a couple of meetups, and I went to the second one, which was on Saturday, and it was well attended. I'm not going to try to name everybody that was there because I'll inevitably forget somebody, but we had, I would say 8 to 10 people show up at Lake Monster Brewing.
That's nice.
On a pretty hot Saturday. We just kind of, it's a nice place to, big airy spot. We sat inside at a big long table and some good watches came out and, some good chatting. And so, yeah, it was a lot of fun. Yeah. Always encourage people if you're passing through to put out the word in the meetups channel on Slack. And, it's always fun to kind of just do an impromptu thing with folks. So great fun.
Absolutely.
And thanks to Steve for initiating that.
Yeah, that's great. Glad to hear it. I saw a few of the pics, and I saw Tom Place had done his sort of AI video, rethinkings of things that happened. I saw you throw a guy through a plate glass window.
Exciting. It's my alter ego.
Exactly. And speaking of meetups, let's not forget that we have a meetup with Citizen at Windup Chicago on July the 10th in the evening. That's the Friday. It'll be 7 to 9 at Forbidden Root. And stay tuned to the Slack and an upcoming episode for information about the RSVP. But that'll be really good. And Jason, my flights are booked. Your flights are booked.
Yeah, we're good to go.
We're good to go. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a fun few days in Chicago. Just a month away.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to do some sushi, as usual, you and I, and our meetup on Friday. And then Saturday, we've got the show, kind of the first half of the day. And then we're going to go do some diving for the Windup in a Lake, organized by our buddy Chris Soule, among others. And that should be a lot of fun. And turn around and head back on Sunday, back home, after some morning shenanigans, I'm sure. But it should be a kind of a whirlwind trip, but always fun to meet folks. We skipped last year's Windup in Chicago, so it'll be good to be back. I had a little sneak peek of Windup in San Francisco just for a couple of hours last month, and that was a lot of fun, but Chicago is always
great.
A favorite. So
for sure. Yeah. And then beyond that, it looks like you and I had a loosely similar automotive-themed weekend.
Yeah, right.
You were car shopping. I was reviving a car, kind of pulling out the defibrillator and getting the Jeep up and running. How did yours go?
Pretty well. It started last week. I'm in the enviable position of not really having to make a quick decision. So I've just started to look. This is actually a car for my girlfriend, Christy, whose existing car will be passed on to her daughter at some point here later in the summer. So we're starting to look for a replacement. And, you know, those who know me might be surprised to hear of my recent love might be a bit of a strong word for a Toyota Prius. I begrudgingly, occasionally drive Christy's Prius or did that starting last year. And I've really kind of grown to like this car. It hauls a lot of stuff. It's very versatile. Obviously, the gas mileage is great. I can't say stylistically it's my taste, but I've just really kind of come to appreciate kind of the opposite end of the car nerd spectrum as opposed to my Land Rovers.
The appliance spectrum.
The appliance.
Yeah, or the appliance end.
Exactly, right.
Hey, there's somebody said for a really good fridge, right?
Exactly, right. And I like your, we've been talking over the past week or so about cars and that sort of thing, kind of philosophy of cars. And I liked your point about how, you can buy a car as an enthusiast vehicle. But if you're not in it for that, you might as well get the most practical thing. And
totally.
The Prius is that. It's an A to B vehicle. It's also extremely practical, very reliable. I had some fun replacing the front bumper on the existing one here, which was such an easy process to go to the dealership and buy the bumper and spray it and then put it on pretty easily. So I'm kind of enjoying that aspect of a very different sort of vehicle. And so, long story short, I'm seeking a replacement Prius, actually looking for the bigger version. I don't know if it's called the V or the 5. It looks like a Roman numeral 5. Who knows? It's more of the wagon version that they produced for a couple of years. And have one in mind, kind of narrowed down, just kind of waiting for something on it that needs fixing from the used car dealer before, you know, making a decision on that. But yeah, just taking my time and looking around and kind of having fun. I haven't shopped for a car in a good long time, so it's kind of fun to dip back into that world.
It's a good time. I'm glad. Hopefully you score something you're really happy with, and it's nice and reliable, and it's easy to live with, and that gives you the sort of brain space and budget and the rest of it to deal with cars that aren't
exactly.
Perhaps like old British SUVs,
right?
although to be fair, both of yours have actually been quite reliable, so I'm not sure that always holds up.
Yeah, right.
Especially if you're willing to do a bit of wiring yourself, which is brings us to my lovely Jeep.
Yeah, right. Speaking of 4x4s with electrical issues.
Yeah. So yeah, I've I guess it would have been that weekend you were here last year.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah and I had just transitioned from, I guess we had the Wrangler and the Toyota minivan, the Sienna,
mm-hmm.
at the same time. We just got in the van, and I think I kept the Jeep in like by my house because you were around, and we were going to be doing a fair bit of driving. If you remember, we went down to the marathon event.
Yeah.
In Martin's neighborhood, and we drove down with the Freedom panels, the front part of the roof off,
mm-hmm.
and the weather looked fine. So I just, you know, I was in a good mood. That's usually when I make my worst decisions, and you know, went into the party, and then partway through, just could hear just a torrent of rain.
Oh,
outside.
That's right, yeah.
And it was up to the ankles in there. Everything, of course, you know, it's a Jeep. It's fine. It was already rusty, so I'm sure we only contributed a small percentage in addition to that. But shortly after that, it went to live just in my parents' driveway. They have a driveway that can fit more than a few cars. And where I live in Richmond Hill, I can just fit the one, and you're not allowed to street park. So it becomes this sort of complicated scenario if you want to do two vehicles and not put one in the garage, which is now full of bikes and strollers and tires and all that kind of stuff. So I lived at my parents' spot, and of course my dad was, you know, starting it every now and then one day it just wouldn't start, and I said, yeah, that's going to be the battery. There is a ground issue, so there's a open circuit somewhere, probably due to some damage to one of the front fenders, you know, that tore a light out, and I just have to get in and sort that wiring, and I just haven't. I tried to reestablish the ground. It didn't make a difference. This probably isn't that interesting to most people. So anyways, went out, got really lucky, actually. This never happens to me, so I will share it on the show, but I took the battery over to Canadian Tire, which is like the local auto parts sort of option for me, and it's where I bought the battery a few years ago, same you know, chain. And I walked in and put it down and said, just another one of these, please. This one is, you know, it shows a charge, but it doesn't have enough cranking power. And so they're like, oh, just one second. And they asked me for my information. And they're like, did you buy this for the Jeep? I said, yeah, yeah. And they said, oh, warranty's up tomorrow. So free one.
I can't believe that.
Wild, right?
Yeah.
And so they did a bit of paperwork and handed me a brand new battery.
Wow.
I got that back to my parents the next day, put it in the Jeep. Thing fired right up. It did not want to move from where it was. So with some careful clutch work and a lot of throttle, we were able to defeat the rust on all of the rotors. And once that was kind of cleared up and we took it for a shakedown drive and got it sprayed off at the car wash, everything was good to go. And it did a really solid, smooth 3-hour drive up to the cottage.
Oh, nice.
On route, because I had an empty vehicle, on route, I stopped by to pick up a barbecue. This has been my barbecue summer. I've bought and built two barbecues so far. for those curious, both were 400 series Weber spirits. Seemed to be the best, or at least among the two or three best under $1,000 Canadian for a barbecue. So this is a 435, which is a nice big four burner. Everything's metal. I've now built two of these myself. Had some help with the first one. A little bit of help does go a long way in the starting phases, but once you've got the basic frame built, most of it just kind of snaps together. Nicely designed, easy to put together. Everything's metal. Everything's replaceable. I like Weber stuff. Anyway, so picked up one of those at Home Depot on the way, got it up to the cottage. So kind of two birds, one stone with getting the Jeep up there for the summer. You know, we don't have a trailer hitch on the van, and I don't really want to treat the van like a tractor.
Yeah.
If I don't have to. So we just figured it was just sitting there. It costs nothing to insure. So simply, you know, I took it out of storage in terms of insurance and got it up to the cottage. So now we've got that up there as well. And a new barbecue. It was a pretty good weekend, actually. Got that done. Had a bit of nice weather on Sunday, just kind of sitting around. Watched the, you know, Monaco F1 and made some, you know, first cook was Costco hot dogs. An absolute favorite for me and for Sarah. So that was delicious. And then we did a couple steaks that evening. Worked beautifully. And my parents, we got them the same one earlier in the summer, and it's been lovely.
Wow. Yeah, sounds like a classic summer weekend. Jeez. Fixing a car and, yeah.
And to be clear, I have no relationship with Weber. People love to claim anything that I bring up. I got $50 off because it was on sale at Home Depot, but otherwise these were bought at full price by me with my own money. I'm not a Weber ambassador or guerrilla marketer. Not yet. Hey, I'm open to it. I mean, yeah. I've been talking up Traeger for years. Man, I just spent some time cleaning the Traeger yesterday.
Huh.
That is a grimy job if you let it go a little bit too long.
I can imagine. Yeah. Wow.
But yeah, so it's been nice so far. And yeah, that was my weekend. Really nice to have the Jeep back. Just a delight to drive stick again. And I took the Freedom panels off and did that drive up with a lot of wind and noise in my hair and face. But really nice. And it'll be useful to have up there for, you know, towing trailers to the dump or moving stuff around the property, or even just having a second vehicle if we need it. And it's also like the ideal going for ice cream for the afternoon. We like to drive up to Minden. There's a cool ice cream spot. There's actually Boschkung Brewery has a nice spot there as well. But there's a great ice cream spot that the girls like. And myself and Sarah I can undo the four or five bolts.
Yeah.
It should be six. I think I have five left. That hold the top on, the main part of the top,
yeah,
and lift it off. It's not that heavy. I've actually put it back on once by myself in duress. That was difficult, but it's a two-man job. So you can just pop the tops right off, go for a drive, come back, throw them back on before any weather comes in. So nice to have up there for sure.
Yeah, that's great. You park it undercover somewhere up there, or is it sitting out getting bird poop on it and that sort of thing?
It is sitting out getting bird poop on it for sure, just like it did at my parents for the last 8 months. I'm definitely not at this point going to become precious about the paint finish.
Yeah, good.
I believe that ship has largely sailed. This is very much a tool for our enjoyment. And, you know, if I could, before this vehicle moves on to its final, you know, resting point, if I could teach a couple more people how to drive stick in it, that would be great.
Yeah.
And certainly we have the space in the room and the little trails and stuff like that at the cottage are kind of fun. So had my 11-month-old son out in it, kind of crawling around the property, and he was having a blast with the horn and that kind of stuff. So
nice.
Yeah.
Very. Oh, speaking of, okay, this is a bit of an aside, but speaking of 4x4s, it just reminded me that the remote controlled Camel Trophy Land Rover that you sent me as a gift,
yeah,
I think it was last year or the year before. It scares Ruby the dog when I buzz it around the house. So I don't use it much in the house, but then, you know, we got Smitty the cat and we've put a harness on her and we tether her out in the middle of the yard. She loves that thing. So I bring it out in the yard and I just buzz it around. It that thing's amazing. It goes through the tall grass. It goes over little sticks and, you know, mulch, and it just looks in its element, and it's just such a blast to sit there and cruise it around and watch both animals kind of perk up their ears and chase it around. I put Ruby's favorite fetching ball on top of it on the roof rack and buzzed it around, and she took the ball off the top of it. I mean, it's just been loads of fun. I mean, in a very juvenile way, but it's great.
Oh man, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Sounds really good for sure. You'll have to send me a video of that, cause I'd love to see it rolling around rolling around the driveway. That'd be, or around the backyard. That's a good time. I've great. Definitely looked into those, and even especially the ones that are like construction equipment.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Backhoes and dump trucks and that kind of stuff. But my son's, you know, not old enough to, like, he's obsessed with cars. We do a lot of Hot Wheels, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's his number one toy, but we're not at the point where he would understand what we're doing. But as soon as we're there, it's going to be costly for sure. Yeah. But very cool stuff. Well, hey, how about some wrist check, and then we'll get into the start of the Slack Q&A for 2026. Pretty exciting day.
It is exciting. Yeah, I need a little help with today's watch. So I'm wearing my my Zin 144S. This is the all black Zin chronograph that I bought from Tom Place last fall in Toronto after a few whiskeys.
Allegedly.
Yes. Yeah. I absolutely adore this watch. And my problem with it is I am just not an all black watch person. And that goes to the mainly to the strap, you know, this kind of all black bracelet, all black watch. Off the wrist, like just when I see this watch, I'm absolutely smitten with it. I just adore it. I put it on and I'm like, it just doesn't feel like me. And I'm really trying hard. I want to keep this watch. I love this watch. And I'm just curious, like I would love for either from you, James, or, you know, if people want to write to me on Slack or pitch in on the episode chat or something of the kind of an ideal strap choice for this. That's not leather. I mean, I could do NATO, but my quandary is, I know you can order NATOs with black hardware, but I really like the hardware on my straps to match the finish of the watch. So right. That's a priority for me. Could be something rubber, canvas, mm-hmm. NATO, whatever. So I'm open to ideas. I just want to switch it up a bit from this beautiful black Porsche design bracelet that Tom sold it to me on, which is, it fits the watch beautifully. But like I said, all black bracelets, just for some reason, I just find I don't wear them very much. So right. That's where I'm at.
Yeah. The first one that leaps to mind, if we're not doing leather, because mm-hmm. like a brown bund would look very cool with that watch and be very you.
Yeah.
Maybe a nice like rally style strap could work, but it's the summer. Mm-hmm. You're going to destroy that strap very quickly. That's a fall option, right?
Yeah.
I would probably go Hirsch Pure. I remember wearing the black Hirsch Pure with my 144 GMT.
Yeah.
And it suits the watch really nicely and it can fit into that lug space. Like normally I would just say just buy the Marathon. Like if you're going to buy a nice rubber strap, buy the green or the black Marathon 20
yeah.
mil.
Yeah. Green,
I don't know that it would fit into that gap without trying it.
Yeah.
But I wear my green Marathon on anything that's 20. I really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I also think a green strap would work with the black case and the orange accents.
Mm-hmm.
You could obviously do a TGN 10. With black hardware, that might be a little bit fancier or flashier. It's quite a flashy, sort of bright, excited sort of strap. But I would go Hirsch Pure, and I'm almost positive in that at one time I said I wish they made a green one, and then a bunch of people who listened sent me links to a green one that just wasn't on the website I was checking.
Yeah.
So the Hirsch Pure, I think, also comes in green, and that's pure rubber, so it doesn't wear like FKM.
Yeah.
And I think they look pretty good and they're very much designless. They're a strap of rubber with a little bit of a curvature on the inside to help deal with warmth and sweat and that sort of thing.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll add that to the short list.
If you can find one, I think you'd be happy with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I have way too many straps already and I keep emptying my box upside down on the table, hoping like the magic strap will just sort of pop out and appear. But, anyway,
so. Hey, been there.
Yeah,
for sure.
Right. And you've got something interesting on today. Is this one that's in for a review?
This one's in for review. It's a watch that so many people have either messaged me about or asked me like, hey, why, you know, is this as good as people say it is? And that's the new, so the 2026 Longines Hydro Conquest Diver in 39 millimeters.
Mm-hmm.
And the main culprit in pestering me about this watch is Thomas Holland.
Yeah.
You know, of Throttle House and the Grand Tour. He was very much keen on it, and I thought obviously Longines makes a quality watch, an incredible watch at the price point. I think that's been my experience. I absolutely love my titanium Zulu, the Hodinkee LE, but this is a $2,200 dive watch, and I've had it on my wrist for maybe 36 hours at this point, and it's just deeply impressive.
Hmm.
It basically nails everything you want from a watch if you want to go that step up from Seiko. That really feels like you're getting most of the way to a Tudor.
Yeah.
This is it.
Huh.
But let's keep in mind, this is $2,200 on a bracelet.
Wow.
You can get it on a rubber strap. You can get it on a mesh. You can get it on a bracelet. It comes in a black dial with a black bezel. It comes in a black dial with a blue bezel. It comes with a black dial with a gray bezel, I believe.
Hmm.
It comes in a full blue, which is what I've got, which is just a very navy, very elegant, classy. And then it comes like in a full green.
Yeah. Wow. Right? Look at the variations. Really cool.
These are half the money of a Black Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's worth considering, but I don't think this is a watch you'd buy exclusively because it's a good deal. It just feels like a watch that's reasonably priced in that like 2017 way of pricing watches, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah.
This feels like where Omega kind of left over the last 20 years as they went up market and they opened the door for Longines. The case is really great. It's 39 millimeters. It's nice and thin. The bezel's 120 click. Not overly loomed. I would say the loom is maybe the part that makes it feel more dress diver than tool watch, which is honestly kind of fine. The loom is fine. It, you could still read it in the middle of the night. It just doesn't have that like Seiko instant insane burn when you come in from outside.
Yeah.
But there's still plenty there. The dial's quite nice. It's applied markers. It has a date window with like a proper frame. The bracelet is probably the thing I'm weirdly the most impressed by. It uses split pins, so that's a little bit of a pain as you kind of get the sizing sorted out.
Yeah.
But you'll be able to do it pretty quickly because it has push button sliding adjustment, very similar to like what's in the Tudor.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a quick release, which my titanium bracelet does, but the build of this feels really good. I think it suits the watch really nicely. The crown is good. The finishing on the case is good. Like it's all, I think if this watch came in at $500 less than a Black Bay, you'd still be like, yeah, there's the competition.
Yeah.
So at $2,200, I had said that it was sort of half what a Black Bay 58 might cost. It's actually less than that, as the current running price of a Black Bay 58 on the bracelet's $5,250. And I don't know that they're direct comparisons. The Black Bay has the Tudor catalog of design. It's maybe a better lineaged product than this one. And the other thing is, and I you know, I'm calling the balls and strikes here. You are a big piece of the appeal of the Longines is its design, which is very Submariner coated in the colorways, in the dial design, in the shiny ceramic bezel. And I don't think that's going to stop most people. I don't think you're buying this as an homage to the Submariner, but it would stop me from jumping into one simply because I don't have a strong appeal. I don't find a strong appeal in the six-digit sub.
Yeah.
I find it quite shiny. I think this wears better than a six-digit sub, being slightly smaller, 39 instead of, you know, Rolex's 41. I really, really like this watch. It's super conventional. A lot of the things that I love about my Pelagos 39, in that they just kind of went the normal option with as many things as possible, make it a very tractable, easy to understand, easy wearing. All of that's present here. And if you can align yourself with the sort of Submariner coded design language, I think it's an absolutely incredible watch. So that's my fairly praise laden coverage of wrist check for the new Hydra Conquest Diver. I'll work out a hands on or something in the future. I'm not sure, but I definitely wanted to talk about it on the show because it comes up a lot, and I think they have nailed something pretty impressive here for the price point for sure.
Yeah, I'm glad they did this kind of redesign of some of the Hydra Conquests because the old one never spoke to me, you know, with those big oversized numerals. They just had a very kind of dated look for quite a few years. They're still on their website, the 41 millimeter size, but these are really sharp.
Yeah, they do this. They do this new version that we'll call it the 2026 in 39 or 42. So if you prefer a slightly larger watch, 42 isn't really that big in the pantheon of dive watches, but it's certainly bigger than 39, but that gives you both options.
Sure. Yeah. All right.
All right, cool stuff. That takes us through wrist check, which means it's my turn to bumble and trip through an explanation of what the Slack Crew and A is. This is the first outing of the 2026 edition of the Slack Crew and A. Normally, if you're listening and this is your first time, apologies for this. It's like trying to get into the lore of something very quickly. Normally, we do a monthly-ish, we do 12 a year of a Q&A for the paid side of the platform, the Slack Crew. And when we do those are based on audio recordings from the crew themselves, which are emailed in, and we edit them in to kind of allow people to hear other voices. It feels a little bit more like a call-in show, all that kind of stuff. This idea actually flips the whole thing on its head, where we go to the Slack, also a benefit of the paid side of our platform, which starts at as little as $5 a month. And we flip it on its head where we ask the crew members to simply do text questions. We open a thread usually for a couple of days. As we record this, we have 67 questions. By the time you're listening to this, we may close the thread. I don't know that we're able to get to much more than that in a year. I think we did 7 or 8 parts in 2025. But it gives us a chance to, one, handle questions from people who don't want to record their voice and do all that work. Two, just very fast questions. Some of these will take 30 seconds to answer. Some will take longer. And three, it gives us a chance where if we don't have a topic that's really burning a hole in our calendar, then we just get to jump into one of these and we have a really good time. So with that, Jason, you want to kick it off with one from our friend Michael Harris?
Yeah, Michael, active Slack user, longtime supporter. Thanks for sending this one in, Michael. He says, in all seriousness, how y'all doing? It's been a crazy few years of TGN Slack with massive growth of the crew, adding two more moderators than we started with, a few buy-sell trade shenanigans, etc. How are you feeling about adding the paid tier? Still feel like it was a good idea? If you could do it all over again from scratch, would you change anything? It's a good question, and a kind of apropos to kind of kick this one off, as James was explaining how this all works. How do you feel about this? I think we're probably both going to have a similar answer about kind of our looking back at our transition to the subscriber model.
Yeah, I mean, the goal was to provide a value to the people who were the most dialed on what we were doing. And on the other side, a little bit of money coming your way and my way, so that if we want to invest in something, if we want more gear, all that kind of thing. That said, I think we're on record. We thought maybe 200 people would do this.
Yeah.
Not upwards of a couple thousand.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fine with whatever the natural kind of comfort zone of that number is. We don't promote the show. We don't run a show Instagram. We don't market the show. We just kind of make the show for the people who want to listen to it. And then occasionally new people find it or it gets recommended by a friend. And I'm largely okay with that. If this was something where it needed to be your and my full-time thing, we could ramp up from here, mm-hmm. right? But yeah. This is essentially us operating at idle. And I think for the $5 a month, or shout out to those of you who do the $100 a year, which gives us a little bit more predictable income, if you will, and you can get yourself a TGN Grey NATO for the first year. Big shout out to people who do that. But between the five, or what's that, nearly $8 a month, I'm very comfortable with the value that we added. You know, I've said in the past when we've had questions like this that I definitely would have gone with Patreon, and I wish we had versus Substack.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't like Substack. It really is designed to do really one thing, and they promote it as being capable of doing a bunch of things. And you can kind of bend it to do some things, but it's wild where, you know, they'll send us an email saying that we're one of their most important, you know, and productive accounts. And we'll go, hey, do you think you could do this like one little change for us? Like, could you make it so we could embed our shows?
Yeah.
And just, oh yeah, that's not possible. they'll take an embed from like 20 other podcast platforms, but not this major one that we use.
Mm.
And it's just like, I'm not sure how that works when you look at like the amount of money that they get from our cut. I'm being very transparent here.
Yeah.
It works. It gets us covered. It gives us a spot for this. But a lot of what Substack offers in aggregate or even in totality has either been replaced in the last several years by other platforms that are less money, possibly free, or can now be done in-house and run from your own platform, run from your own servers, that sort of thing. So yeah, that would be the only one. Patreon, I think, would have enabled us to have some more flexibility and to be able to speak directly to those who are paying for the product versus those who aren't. Otherwise, I think it's worked out really well. There's no way that we would have predicted the Slack would have become kind of the main value driver in that $5 a month. And at the same time, maybe we should have predicted it. I don't know. So I suppose there's a world in which that could have been additive to the pricing scheme, but that's not really the way that Jason and I operate. Like we haven't changed the pricing since we started, and we probably wouldn't unless our scenarios changed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like unless we're able to suddenly add more value or go like, hey, it would need to be this much a month or we can't do it anymore. And we haven't really hit either of those zones. You know, I'm happy to add incremental value, but unless we added a big thing of some sort of video, a monthly video platform or more live stuff or a tour or something like that, otherwise I'm pretty happy with how it's gone.
Yeah.
How about you, Jason?
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think, moving to a subscriber model from ad sales was such a no-brainer and such a natural move for us to have this freedom to do what we want without having to insert, you know, ad reads in the episodes, which neither of us liked when we did that for a short time. It also has really fostered this sense of community. I think there's kind of a mutual trust and respect that was kind of fostered by kind of having this supporter network. Like you said, who could have predicted that Slack would have blown up the way it is to almost, I would say, you know, overshadow the podcast itself as kind of the main driver.
Yeah.
And I think I am so okay with that. I mean, if that's what TGN becomes known for, is this incredibly respectful, robust community, then I'm all for it. So that's great. And the challenge for us going forward is, either to grow TGN carefully or to not grow it at all. I think you mentioned it just before I started here, and it's my feeling as well that we aren't here to grow a big number. I mean, it could be just fine the way it is. It just kind of settles to its natural size, and I think that's kind of happened, and I'm really happy about that. So
yeah, I mean, you and I talk about this with some frequency, and if there was a world in which this was my full time, mm-hmm. I don't even know that I would really change what I feel is working for a set of people that I really feel aligned with, the crew.
Yeah.
I'd probably go additive, like make another show entirely. Mm-hmm. Like there's a world in which TGN could spawn a watch only show.
Yeah.
That would definitely be doable.
Mm-hmm.
Or a weekly show that's more of a panel discussion with a bunch of our buddies. Mm-hmm. You could find a roster of, I mean, it's all people who've been on the show before, but you could find a roster of 15 people.
Yeah.
And then once a week, get 3 or 4 of them on a Zoom call and record that. That'd be fascinating. Mm-hmm. Work really easily. Not that difficult to spin up. And then you would probably break that off so that everybody involved could get paid for it.
Yeah.
Rather than it coming out of the TGM books or whatever. But yeah, I've got 1,000 ideas. But my main goal is like, don't do things that could upset something that's working. You know, if those of you in the audience who have young babies, like you can't make a happy baby more happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just let it sit mm-hmm. to a certain extent, like let it do what it's doing.
Yeah.
I think the show will grow if it deserves to grow. And I think if there's a world in which people are coming to us because of the Slack versus the show, that's going to be a tough world for them to navigate the translation, the internal language, the vibe, but not insurmountable. And like I said, I mean, especially when it comes to the Slack, I'm okay with it being inscrutable. I don't want it to be this like very easy thing that people can just kind of come into.
Yeah.
I want you to kind of have to cross a couple rivers on your way, if you will,
mm-hmm.
So that you're kind of aligned by the time you get there, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But yeah. Thanks for that question, Michael.
Yeah, and thanks for your support, of course. Next up, we've got a question from Elias Garios, who says, new to the chat, so apologies if this has been asked before, but he's curious if either of us have any guilty pleasure hobbies that are very un-TGN.
I couldn't come up with anything. I'm kind of embarrassed.
Well,
I don't like having no answer to a question. TGN's kind of my hobby.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's hard to say because I think, not to overinflate us especially after the answer with Michael, but Slack and the community, but TGN is us, right? I mean, so by default, mm-hmm. anything we do as a hobby is probably already the Granado. I guess if there are things that maybe don't fit the superlatives, you know, adventure, travel, diving, driving, gear and watches, gardening, I think there are a good number of TGN folks that garden. I'm quite passionate about it, especially vegetable gardens. I look forward to, we have a short growing season here, but it's something that I look forward to every May when the last frost is finally left and can start getting stuff in the ground. And just yesterday, I harvested just a massive pile of strawberries and already harvesting kale and arugula and herbs. I've got tomatoes in the ground and squash and chili peppers. Sure. So, it's something that I'm quite keen on and I don't really publicize because it's, gardening is its own thing. And there's a huge, huge world of gardening out there, including several podcasts. And I don't think we need to add gardening to our list at the top of the show here. But that's the one that I come up with.
Yeah. I mean, the show basically is formed around the things that we're into.
Yeah.
So I definitely don't have any hobbies, like even into things like 3D printing.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that necessarily aligns. I remain a huge nerd for random tech.
Mm-hmm.
Try and keep up with as much of it as I can. But like in many ways, it's like tech that reflects the other things. Like I might be printing something that I'm going to use when I'm doing one of the things that would align with the show or whatever.
Yeah.
And between X number of hours a week with Hodinkee, way over a full-time job. And then this, which we have to be which we have kind of designed to be very efficient in terms of the hours we put into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then an 11-month-old son, 2 daughters, Sarah has all of her own hobbies and her own interests, including a couple of beautiful garden beds out back. I don't know that I'm in a phase of my life where there's another hobby that's just waiting to be out there. every 6 months I go through the process of like designing and figuring out all the bits to do like a proper racing sim or a driving sim.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just don't buy it. I just move on. I go like, oh, I'll spend $5,000 or $6,000 now with the Chrysler Ram and the rest of it more. and I'll have something really good, and then I won't have the time to drive it.
Yeah.
Kind of the same reason I haven't bought a sports car. Mm-hmm. What am I going to do? I'm going to sit in the garage and look at it. I got things to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Elias, hopefully you stick around with the show, and it's a pleasure to have you in the audience, of course. And I would love to one day have a really good, totally left field answer to this question. Like if I get into a certain esoteric type of painting or something like that, or keeping orchids or something.
Right.
I'm not sure, but hopefully we can get there one day. But right now I'd say TGN is my hobby, and my hobbies are all reflected on the show.
Well, and I think too, I always refer back to this sort of phrase that I picked up from Ben Clymer many years ago when he was just getting into kind of vintage cars. He called it the civilian side of his life. And I think that he's probably transcended that now, and he's kind of known as a car guy. But back then, you know, I think he was the watch guy. He still is kind of the high priest of horology, as the New York Times called him. And I think, you know, when he got into cars, he liked being able to go to things where he wasn't known in that space. And I think a lot of these kind of, if you want to call them un-TGN hobbies, kind of exist in that area as well. And I kind of enjoy not sharing certain parts of my life that are, you know, not necessarily aligning with some of the stuff that we talk about regularly. So good question. And yeah, well, you know, I'm sure we've got some other things that are sort of internal nerd pleasures of ours, but yeah, gardening is mine. And James, I can, you know, I know you with your tech and 3D printing and stuff, but you know, it's all TGN as far as I'm concerned.
I think so. Yeah. So thanks so much for that question, Elias. And sorry, we didn't have maybe like a more interesting answer. Just, you know, Jason's gardening's not interesting, but I think you get my point.
Yeah.
Next up, let's jump into one from Brendan, who's got a question. Oh, I guess I'm in the wrong mode here. I got to read these questions. You can tell I'm doing Q&As. All right. Next up, let's jump into one from Brendan, who says, I always enjoy listening to you both talk about books and writing, but understandably, a lot of those discussions skew towards spy, thriller, adventure fiction, or TGN related nonfiction. Do either of you have poetry that you find meaningful or that you revisit? How about fiction that strays far afield from the TGN superlatives?
Good question. Just speaking for myself, I actually have written poetry. I still do from time to time. And when I was in college, that was kind of my thing. I was writing short stories and poetry, and I actually had a couple of poems published many years ago. It was back in, you know, when I was a young man, and they were very small, kind of local literary journals, if you will. Nothing that still exists or even can be found online, probably for the best. But yeah, I kind of came up, you know, as an English major, I had to study poetry in school, and I've developed kind of a, you know, small list of poets that I find to be my favorites. Mary Oliver being one. She's just a great, just has a keen eye. She really incorporates a lot of kind of nature observations in her poetry, as does Gary Snyder, who is kind of a beatnik. I think he's still alive, actually. He was a California-based beatnik poet who, a bit of a Zen Buddhist and a mountaineer of all things. So he's some interesting stuff. And then one of my favorites is Michael Ondaatje, who wrote The English Patient as a novel, which is one of my favorites. But also he's a very, very talented poet. He just has such a way with language that I love. So yeah, that's kind of my background with poetry. And I do read kind of fiction that's not aligned with, you know, here we go with the TGN superlatives again, but, you know, it was only in recent years that I discovered kind of adventure thrillers. And when I started fancying myself as kind of an author of those, because I was kind of tired of reading books that required too much sort of mental energy and kind of interpretation. And, but I, you know, I still do read other stuff as well. So, and we've talked about a few of those on past book club episodes.
For sure.
How about you, James?
Yeah, no poetry for me. The last time I think I read poetry was stuff that was offered in, you know, university literature classes, things like that. But lots of books that fall outside. I think a lot that I talk about or have talked about in a previous episode, but if you just want a very quick list, here's six. Secret History by Donna Tartt. Absolutely fantastic. I can't say enough good things. You should just read it. Really any Donna Tartt's gonna do it for you. I prefer Secret History. But they're all good ones. More recently, I read Martyr by Kaveh Akbar via the Anthony Jeselnik kind of end of the year book list. Absolutely incredible. My buddy and colleague Tim Jeffries bought me One Man's Meat by E.B. White, which is a collection of E.B. White's writing. And it's absolutely awesome. It's just, I can't tell you how much I enjoy it, how different it is from what I normally read. You can kind of sit in and read one of them and get out. It's a, you know, nice sort of short, not short, they're not stories necessarily, they're like essays. And they're great. Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel. Anybody who's read it is currently nodding. Absolutely incredible piece of sort of pseudo science fiction, but not really, but at the same time it is. But Washington Bullets by Vijay Prashad. And then as I've spoken about, I think probably since very early episodes, pretty much any Chuck Klosterman, an essay, a full-on book, whatever you like. You pick a topic that hits you. If you like basketball, obviously we're in the middle of the NBA finals right now. If you like basketball, go back and read his interview with Steve Nash. Absolutely incredible. Really, really good. Some stuff I remember from that piece of work that I try and incorporate into my own writing. I just like his writing. I like the way his mind works. His audiobooks are incredible. The ones that he reads. These are from years and years ago. I read and listened to those probably within the first couple of years that Audible even existed when I was in university and shortly thereafter. But there's six starting points for you for sure.
Yeah, good ones. And I think I would encourage Brendan also to, if you're not already, to join the book club channel on Slack. There's a lot of good discussion there, and I get a lot of recommendations from there myself. So,
yeah, those guys are voracious readers.
Yeah,
and all sorts of, it's not just spy thrillers and military dramas and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Thanks so much for that question, Brendan. Next up, we've got one from Steve W. He says, what's the favorite hike you've ever taken? It can be a favorite for any reason, absolute beauty, sense of accomplishment, pushing yourself, or seeing some cool animal. And a bucket list question, say you had a full week to go anywhere to hike in the world, where would you go and which hike would you take? Thanks so much. All right, Steve W., good question. Jason, what's the standout favorite or couple of favorites?
Yeah, a couple of favorites. I mean, it's hard to narrow down to the absolute favorite. Just last year, just a little over a year ago, I was in Scotland for that project with Paulin, and then spent a few extra days with Christy over on the Isle of Skye. And we did a pretty amazing hike on this in this area called the Quirang, which is hard to pronounce. We can throw it in the show notes, but it's this kind of cirque of or amphitheater of cliffs. I'm not sure what caused them to form this way, but it's sort of this narrow valley with these very steep, jagged peaks kind of all around it. And you kind of hike the circuit around and through the bottom of it. That was really beautiful. And what really stood out was the fact that it was light until about midnight when we were there. And so it was such a luxury to be able to set off on a hike at, 4 or 5 in the afternoon without having to worry about being caught out after dark.
I love that.
Everyone was kind of gone for the day, so we had the whole place to ourselves. I did a hut-to-hut hike years ago in the White Mountains out in New Hampshire, which is part of the Appalachian Trail. Staying in these kind of community huts, it was a very, it was just a great, kind of opportunity to kind of intersperse some really tough vertical hiking out there, which really caught me off guard how steep and rocky the trails are out there, with kind of these evening sort of, not luxury, but you're spending it in a hut with lots of people from around the world that were on the way as well. Mm-hmm. Up here in Minnesota, we've got the Superior Hiking Trail, which is really world class. It starts in Duluth and goes all the way up to the Canadian border. Many of the sections of the trail have a view out over the lake and some great wildlife. And then finally, this trip I took over a decade ago to New Zealand and hiked on the South Island on a well-known path called the Milford Track, which was a three-day hike, also a hut-to-hut, that just went over some mountain passes, crossed some snowy areas with incredible waterfalls. The guides were calling in helicopters to ferry us past landslide dangers. It was just a really, really amazing experience and a beautiful hike. And those who've been there will know what I'm talking about. And then it finishes at Milford Sound, which is just this jaw-dropping kind of fjord that kind of is an inlet from the ocean. So those are ones that stand out. I mean, there are many more. And in terms of where I would go, that's a tough one. I Switzerland is hard to beat. I've done a lot of hiking over there and kind of do some longer hikes there where you can hike from one end to the other and then take the train back to where you started, I think would be really fun to do. I've never really had the Everest base camp on my list. I've always kind of felt like it feels a bit cliche, a little bit, I don't know. I guess if you want to go to Everest, not that I ever want to climb Everest, but I feel like, why would you just go to the base camp? I want to climb something if I'm over there, but that's not in my future. So, How about you? You've done a good deal of hiking as well. What are your favorites?
There's the classics in Vancouver that I've talked about for years on this show. The Gross Grind of Crown Mountain was always kind of like the one I looked forward to once I was fit enough. So the Gross Grind is 2.9 kilometers almost straight up the ridge of the North Shore Mountains, up the slope of the North Shore Mountains. Then you get to the top and you traverse a pathway across a few other lower peaks and then down into a valley and then up into Crown Mountain, which is the highest peak visible into the North Shore. And that was always an absolute favorite. That was probably, I think, maybe 10 or 12 kilometers, maybe a little bit more than that. The one time you can download, so you don't have to hike down the back down the North Shore. Mm-hmm. You can come down on a gondola, assuming that's working. If you've listened to previous episodes, you'll remember one where it wasn't working and I walked down. And that was a long day for sure. Hmm. What else stands out? The Coleman Glacier via Heliotrope Ridge, which is on the side of Mount Baker. When I first started spending time in Washington, we were down there for, I think, a Canadian Thanksgiving, if I remember correctly. We were staying in Glacier. My brother and I did this hike, and it was the first time I had seen a glacier with my own eyes. I just wasn't ready for the size at all. And it was like quite, it's a moment that I just remember. If you've ever had the fun of coming out of a tunnel in the Alps and seeing the expanse, it's kind of, it hits you really hard. And that's what that glacier was like. That was a great one. Not a tough hike or anything. Mount Brunswick was probably the most personal to me, which is in the mountains, in the Howe Sound Mountains. It's the highest peak. I think it's just shy of 1800 meters. You kind of start down against the water in the sound and then climb up. And I did it a couple times. I finally was able to do it quite quickly, had really good weather, had really good fitness, all that kind of stuff dialed in. And I still go back and look at those photos. You're just on top of the world. You're kind of ahead of everything else or above everything else that you can see. Just an incredible hike. Really, really good, really fast, really tough uphill hike that kind of pushed me to the limits. So, I mean, I used to do a ton of hiking when I lived out west. It was one of my favorite things to do. It was something I trained for all year so that by the time May and June came around, I just had to get my mountain legs back.
Yeah.
And once I had them back, I was out. I was out and going. And then as far as a dream goes, I've talked about it a ton. I'd planned to try and do it for my 40th. We'll delay that to some extent, but the Tour de Mont Blanc. I'm not sure you could get it done in a week. I'd have to be quite fit. But I could do pieces of it for sure in a week. I think it's like 170 kilometers. But that one looks like the absolute dream as far as a nice tour of the Swiss Alps would go, for sure.
Oh yeah, that'd be amazing. Wow. Yeah. All right.
I can put some of that into the show notes, the all trails or whatever. But if you're going hiking in Vancouver or around Vancouver and you want any advice, just drop me a note on Slack. We can figure it out.
All right. Thanks for that one, Steve W. Next up, we've got a question from Andrew Ive. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. Apologies if not. Who asks, what book or TV series recently has either captivated you or made you question reality or taste? Just real bad. What is the bare minimum a show or book requires these days to be considered decent in your view? James, got some opinions here on TV or books and kind of what makes one hold your interest?
With books, I tend to get to them eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm not in it after a couple of chapters, I probably won't keep with it.
Yeah.
And then I'll let it sit on the Kindle, and a couple of years later, I'll pick it back up and try again. So I don't know that I've read anything. Like I'm a picker and chooser when it comes to books. I'll just read whatever somebody said was the best book from last year. How bad is a book like that going to be? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I can't really weigh in on anything that made me like question taste, whether it's my taste or the taste of the book or its audience. And then as far as TV shows, the last one that hit me in any meaningful way, like a show where I wanted to see every episode, I was really dialed and invested into the episodes and I can't wait for more. That's The Agency.
Yeah.
Probably the only example in the last several years. There's lots of shows that I like.
Mm-hmm.
Lioness. I talked about The Pitt on some recent episodes. It's one of those ones where like if Sarah was like, I don't want to watch TV tonight.
Yeah.
I'd go like, all right, fine. I'll read a book. I'll do something else.
Yeah.
Whereas like if there's an Agency episode waiting, I'm gonna have to watch that.
Yeah, everything gets set aside for that. I'm the same way.
I think it's back in 10 days.
Yeah.
7 days from when you hear this, I think, something like that, close to that. So very excited for the second season of that one. It looks gnarly already.
Yeah.
let's see, you know, the as, yeah, and then like books that I got dialed into recently, I enjoyed The Terminal List.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed Cry Havoc, which took you back into Vietnam, and I got to learn a ton of stuff. And I was, there was one of those books where I would stop, you know, I'd put the thing down, or use the highlight feature in the Kindle to get a definition.
Yeah.
Just so I could stay on top of the acronyms and the other stuff like that, which I like. And then I think I talked about a ton on the show. Thompson's The Getaway. I can't recommend it enough. Not written like anything else I'd really come across. Very detailed, very tactile, very fingertip, very inside somebody's head. And just really, really good. How about you, Jason? Anything really grip you? Anything you're like pretty pumped about?
Well, The Agency for sure. And I think, you know, we're so spoiled for choice when it comes to good TV series these days. They've completely, in my mind, usurped, for a large part, movies. And, you know, a good movie kind of comes along. You know, it's like one in every 10 movies is like worth like actually going out and dropping money on, personally. Some people will just see anything and everything. But with TV series, like I almost can't keep up. There's so much good stuff out there. You know, I think of, you know, The Agency is definitely at the top of the heap, but you get something like Slow Horses, which is not far behind in terms of quality. Yeah. Such a great show. In kind of a different realm or different kind of vibe is The Diplomat, which I've really enjoyed. Yeah, and then recently DTF St. Louis finished that one. I was really pleasantly surprised, kind of took me off guard. Jason Bateman and David Harbour and that one, and they did a really good job with that. I would say if there's anything that kind of causes me to abandon a show after like an episode or two, it's just like, by and large, like I find, and this is a complete generalization, but like British and European TV is just superior still to a lot of American shows, with some exceptions, in terms of kind of the realism of the characters. I think if a show has too many, and I, you know, hate to be prejudiced in this way, but you know, too many pretty people or too many kind of perfect scenarios or kind of glib responses and things, it just strikes me as just doesn't hit right. So I abandon that. So I think just more realism and less predictability, I think, is kind of my criteria. And then in terms of books, recently, fiction-wise, North Woods by Daniel Mason
was
fantastic. I loved that book. And then most recently, London Falling by Patrick Radden Keefe as a nonfiction book was just an absolute, could not put that one down. I'll read anything that guy does for nonfiction reporting. So yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the one thing you said, what's a bare minimum for a show? I don't know how to quantify that, if I'm honest, or maybe I don't understand the question. I would say the thing that gets me out of interest very quickly is when it's kind of clear that the show was written from an entirely casual point of view. It feels like there's a lot of shows out right now that are more about the celebrity that they have in the show, or the fact that the show is exclusively very beautiful people, or that it's kind of a premise that's kind of the hook, and things like the plot line, the dialogue, and all that kind of go out the window.
Yeah.
If you need an example of this, Your Friends and Neighbors on Apple TV is just like, it's some of the most vapid. It feels like they went out and watched, you know, it feels like they went out and watched Weeds and Californication and, you know, some of these like very high level, like even elements of like, it just looks like they went there and they took those plot lines and they slotted famous, pretty handsome, you know, beloved people into them. And there's like a moment in an episode that'll be awesome. And then the rest of it will just kind of be like nothing. And it all kind of feels like a show made for somebody where they go, well, this doesn't matter. A person's gonna be on their phone by this point.
We
got to fill the next 6 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And you go like, and I'm sitting there going like, well, I know exactly what's going to happen next. And I know the next 5 or 6 things that are going to happen because I've seen the show before, just not set in the same place and not with the same people.
Yeah.
The bare minimum is I don't want anything that's like casual.
Right.
I just don't.
Right.
Look at my extreme love for Michael Mann, the least casual guy of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Every detail matters. Everybody's intense.
Yeah.
Nobody's relaxed. Mm-hmm. You know, that's sort of my zone.
All right. Good one. We've had a couple of kind of literary and TV and movie questions. We've had I'm just scrolling back here. We've really haven't had any watch questions, which is quite interesting.
Doesn't look like we're going to get there either.
Yeah, so. Right. Well,
All right. Well, look, I think it's been a good one so far, but let's close it out with another question. And this one's from Dan McFly, who asks, you both seem to be introverts and have always been interested in your thoughts on becoming influencers. Also, how often do you intentionally keep something you're interested under wraps during an episode to avoid attracting extra attention and driving the prices up?
I don't know, James, I would consider myself, and I'm guessing you'd feel the same, as a reluctant influencer. I think, I think it's not something I set out to be, and I don't know about you, but it just happens, and I think I can't deny that we have some influence on people.
Of course.
But I don't think it's anything we've set out to be, and I personally feel like, you know, my tastes and opinions are just those of an average, you know, flawed person with very specific interests, no different from anyone else's. And one thing I've enjoyed about the Slack group is just being up. I'm quite awed by the amount of talent and wisdom and things that we have among our community. And I'm just like, don't listen to me, go to Slack and like read what all these other amazing people are doing as well. So that's kind of, you know, a bit of an aside to the question, but, I don't know. In terms of kind of the main question here, do you intentionally keep things under wraps? I haven't gotten that sense.
No, I mean, I don't even like the assertion, if we're just being honest. The entire purpose of the show is to talk about what we're into.
Yeah.
If something's good, it will get the attention that it deserves, whether we talk about it or not. And and I would never be like, oh, let's not talk about that because I'm trying to buy it or something. I think there's been lots of times where we've talked about stuff and it later became unbuyable because it sold out, or maybe it was just a one of one.
Mm-hmm.
Extra attention is great. Good things should have attention. And as far as driving the price up, that's super dependent upon what's being sold and how.
Yeah.
You know, if we want to talk about watches that we really like that are kind of, you know, like a 2254 Omega. Yeah. Those have gotten a lot more expensive in the span of time that I sold mine. And now I don't know that we're to blame to that. We're part of the course of people who like and promote those watches. Kind of the same thing with an aerospace.
Yeah.
They're more expensive now than they used to be for sure. But no, I would never like hang on to some information that the goal of that information is talking about it. We're making content.
Yeah.
And I think it would make the show a weaker thing if we were saying like, oh, let's leave that off so we can wet our beaks first.
Yeah.
I you and I aren't that active of buyers in any scenario, aside from, let's be clear, like $10-$15 Amazon straps, I might have a problem for sure.
Right.
But we're not market movers in these spaces. And then as far as the first part of the question, you know, I think the influencer thing has been largely not comfortable for me.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because the world became kind of a meaner place over the last 7 or 8 years. And as your audience grows, you eventually get to the point where there is a percentage of the audience who has no history with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're coming in based on something you said today or last week, and they don't have the context of understanding why you might've gotten there, what you know, what other jobs you've had, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, I think you can look at the way that it's happened to me. I just have slowly pulled back from scenarios where I have to interface with that type of an audience. I make investments, critical, time-worthy investments into things like the Slack and speaking to people who are, you know, in the zone,
yeah,
so to speak. And I do less and less on Instagram and in the more like broad scope, super casual sort of settings. So like I'll put a photo up. I don't really care what anybody says about the photo. And you just kind of move on. So as a proper introvert, I'm deeply compartmentalized as to where I put my energy. And I would say that the longer we've been doing this, the more I've found ways to keep my energy in places and modes that feel like it's accepted in a way that feels realistic.
Yeah.
But, you know, you do something for 20 years, your audience comes and goes, they change, they evolve.
Yeah.
And you can definitely end up with a type of attention that isn't comfortable, and that comes with it. It's not something you have to change. It's something you have to manage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point. All right. Good, thoughtful questions. Really actually very thoughtful, outside the box questions here. So we appreciate everybody that wrote in: Michael, Elias, Brendan, Steve W, Andrew, and Dan. Appreciate that. And yep. There's plenty more to come. James, you said 60 plus questions. As we're sitting here, I'm seeing more come in. And we'll close that thread down shortly here. We'll never get through all of them this year, but thanks to everybody that wrote in.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was super fun, and we'll get to more of these. Definitely several more over the summer as Jason and I try and, you know, dial back a little bit and take some time off. We can bank episodes like these, so we do really appreciate the questions, as allows us to kind of manage the time in scenarios where there's not a huge watch release or, you know, an earth-shattering guest, of which, you know, we love when both happens, but we also enjoy the space between.
Yeah.
All right. How about some final notes?
Yeah, I've got a quick one. You'll recall my Defender Trophy qualification participation back in, I guess it was May. Defender, or, you know, Land Rover, they've been kind of slowly editing together and putting out short videos that kind of encapsulate or summarize the different qualification rounds from around the world. They've done Taiwan, I think they did South Africa, a couple other places that they put out on their YouTube channel. And they just yesterday they dropped the North American qualification round video summary. I don't appear, or maybe not sadly, I don't appear anywhere in this video. There were three waves of 40 people, so there were a lot of people, and looked to me like they did most of the filming in maybe the other two rounds after they kind of, I was part of one of the early rounds, and so maybe they kind of learned from ours and filmed more of the stuff with the other two. But great to kind of see. I was quite proud to see, you know, how great it looked and how great the vehicles looked and some of the challenge events and things. So just kind of fun to watch that. And for me, it was a bit of a trip down memory lane. But if you're interested in seeing how they went about selecting the top two Canadians and the top two Americans for the finals in October in Africa, you can check that out on YouTube.
That's great. Yeah, when I saw this in the show notes, I watched a piece of it. And kudos for them for putting out a 17-minute video.
Yeah.
So it doesn't just feel like a 3-minute ad.
Yeah.
That runs before the video that you want to get to. And this looks like a proper bunch of adventure for sure.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. All right. What do you got?
Yeah. Mine this week is actually weirdly in a similar sort of space, but definitely more on the lifestyle side, I guess, than something as gnarly as the Defender Trophy. This is a really good video I watched earlier this week from a YouTube channel called Silver Symbol Workshop. And it's just a guy showing this build of a 4-season tiny shelter, which he made out in the woods on a wood platform that's fully self-supported with heat and power. But it's based on like a hardcore sort of foam insert that would normally go into the back of a pickup truck. And instead he's put it kind of out on its plank, and it's room for a couple of people. Obviously more designed for like sleeping or possibly just resting, getting out of the gnarly weather.
Yeah.
But just a really, really cool idea. And really thoughtfully put together. Like, you can tell this is a guy who's gone down every other version and decided to kind of tailor this for his needs. Just wait till you get to the heater, which is entirely enclosed in a Pelican case.
Oh, wow.
It's just like really, really fun, really cool. Like, this is stuff that I enjoy just kind of watching for, you know, some time. This is a 13-minute video, so you can get in and out of it really easily. I just think he did such a nice job. It's only a month old, so it's still relevant if that matters. And I just think it's a really good, you know, option where maybe you don't want to go do the full bunkie build. Maybe you want something that's truly remote. And then this, without all the gear, the foam thing is only a few hundred pounds.
Huh.
So it could be moved if you want to move this to a different part of your property.
Yeah.
Or something. But you want something that's akin to a cabin. But as we all know, kind of like with a tent, if you're in the right spot and the weather cooperates, you're really only in your tent or your cabin to have a nap.
Yeah.
If you sleep for the night.
Right.
That sort of thing, right? The rest of it you could probably do elsewhere. And this is just a really cool build. He walks you through how some of the electronics are designed and the heating and all this kind of stuff. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, this is really cool. It looks like, you know, like a camper or a rooftop tent scenario or something like for overlanding, but it's stationary and it's not something that is in the cards for me. I can't see myself doing this, but I love like all the little bits just as I'm kind of scanning through this. It's really fun. I'll give this a watch. Very cool.
Yeah, it's from, so the basic build is from Freedom Campers, which I believe is like, it's a type of styrofoam. So it's very, you can cut it, you can add things to it. So he's adding a roof vent and you know, scenarios for piping in and out heat and all that kind of stuff. I just really enjoyed this. It's fun.
Yeah, nice.
So yeah, that's building the ultimate 4-season tiny shelter packed with survival tech from Silver Symbol Workshop. Pretty solid YouTube channel as well.
Nice. Great name. Symbol. C-Y-M-M-B-A-L.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
cool.
Well, as always, thank you so much for listening and for typing in your questions in the TGN Slack thread. If you'd like to subscribe If you're not in the TGN Slack and you would like to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments, and even consider supporting the show directly, which will get you into the Slack and part of these conversations, please just visit thegraynato.com. Music Throughout is Siesta by Jazzer via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Thomas Berger, who said, "The art and science of asking questions is the source of all knowledge."